Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 40.
In Wuji Country.
The king's back, he's safe, and he's just completely overwhelmed with gratitude.
The monks from Valen Temple, bringing back the king's proper gear, the soaring heaven crown, that jade belt, the ochre robe, the carefree shoes.
Ah, so getting those items back. He initially doesn't even want the throne back. Wants to be a civilian, offers it to the pilgrims. What's that about?
I think it speaks volumes, honestly. Partly about the trauma he's been through, you know, being dead, replaced by a demon. Worldly power probably feels less important after that.
Yeah, compared to just being alive with his family.
Right. But it's also a test for the pilgrims, isn't it? Here's the ultimate prize, worldly power. Are they tempted?
Which, of course, they aren't. Xuanzang's focus is just laser-like. The scriptures. That's it.
That's the only goal. And Sun Wukong's reasons for saying no are just. Classic Wukong. And actually quite insightful, I think.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that.
Well, he basically says, look, I'm used to being a monk. It's simple. It's free. He even implies he's maybe a bit lazy for the demands of being a king.
Ah, lazy Wukong.
And he mentions specifically not liking long hair. It sounds trivial, maybe, but it highlights how different he is from, you know, conventional society and its expectations.
And the big one, he just can't deal with the grind of being emperor.
Exactly. The late nights, the early mornings.
The constant worrying about border reports, floods, grouts.
All that responsibility. He says he prefers the freedom of being a monk. It's funny, but it really underscores his priorities.
Okay, so the king gets it. He understands their real mission. He takes back the throne.
Yep, resumes his duties, issues a great pardon across the land.
And then we get this really quite touching farewell scene.
It is. It's pretty elaborate. They have a big feast for the pilgrims in the East Cabinet.
Nice.
And they commission portraits. The source uses the term joyful countenances of all four of them.
Portraits. Wow.
To be hung in the Golden Throne Hall, the Roya. Like forever.
Yeah.
Commemorating what they did.
That's a serious honor. But then they try to give them actual treasure, right?
Oh, yeah. The state's best stuff. Gold, silver, silks, you name it.
And the pilgrims.
Refuse it all. Politely but firmly.
Their only request is?
The paperwork. Getting their travel document updated.
It's such a perfect detail, isn't it? They interact with the worldly systems just enough to pass through legally.
But take none of the actual wealth or power. It keeps their mission pure.
And that final send-off, it's not just sending servants.
No, no, it's incredibly personal. The king, the queens, the prince, all the top ministers, they personally escort them out of the city gates.
The text uses that phrase.
Yeah, like holding the chariot hub, pushing the wheel. It's this image of maximum respect, almost like they're physically helping them on their way.
Wow.
And the king is weeping, asking them to please come back and visit on their way home. It really grounds the whole episode. You feel the weight of their success, the human connection they made.
Okay, so they leave this high point, gratitude, honor, connection, back on the road. What time of year is it?
The source tells us specifically, end of autumn, beginning of winter.
So the mood changes immediately just with the season.
Absolutely. You leave the palace, the ceremonies, and you're back in nature. The descriptions paint a picture. Frost on the red leaves, rain helping the millet ripen.
Still sounds okay, though. A bit chilly, maybe.
Yeah, there's mention of maybe some lingering warm sun on plum blossoms, but also the wind shaking the mountain bamboo. It feels transitional, natural. You might almost expect a calmer stretch of travel after Wuji.
Almost, but that's not what happens, is it? After maybe half a month, boom, a mountain.
And not just any mountain. The description is immense. Like it reaches the sky, it blocks the sun.
Whoa.
Xuanzang's reaction is instant, fear. He pulls up his horse, calls out to Wukong, already worried about demons.
And Wukong's first response.
It's that classic Wukong reassurance, initially. Just keep walking, don't overthink it, old son's got this covered. A brave face, maybe.
Perhaps. Or maybe he hasn't quite grasped the scale of it yet. Because the details the source gives us about this mountain. There's something else. It's not just big, it feels wrong.
How so? What kind of details?
Well, it mixes the awe-inspiring with the really ominous, okay, high peaks touching the sky, fine. But then deep ravines described as being like the underworld, like you.
Oof, okay.
You've got white clouds, normal enough, but also thick black mist clinging to everything.
Doesn't sound welcoming.
And it gets more specific. The text points out these unsettlingly named places tucked away within it. There's a spirit-holding platform behind the mountain.
Oh, what now? AC. And behind that, there's a demon hiding cave.
Okay, this is definitely not just a geological feature.
Not at all. Even the natural sounds described seem designed to unnerve. There's a dripping spring inside the cave making this ding, 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 ding sound, a winding stream below. It feels like there's something hidden, maybe trapped, pulsing inside this place.
And the animals, usually they just add color.
Here they add to the unease. Yes, there are the usual heaven-jumping monkeys.
Right.
But also antlered deer and these simple-minded boars that are just watching them, standing there staring. It gives you this feeling of being observed, you know?
Creepy.
And mixed in with those are the truly wild things. Tigers looking for lairs at night, dragons emerging from the water in the morning. This mountain feels ancient, powerful, and actively dangerous.
It's alive.
Exactly. And the sounds reinforce that. The cave door opens with a dew sound. Birds suddenly take flight. Beasts move. It feels like the whole place is stirring.
And the feeling it evokes in the travelers.
Pure fear. The text uses words like tarot and trembling.
Wow, what a shift. From being honored guests pushed in a chariot by a king.
To trembling with fear at the foot of a mountain that feels like it actively hates you. The contrast couldn't be more dramatic.
And then the sign appears, the thing that confirms their fears.
The unmistakable signal, a single red cloud.
Where does it come from?
Rises right out of a hollow in the mountain. And it shoots straight up, way up into the sky.
Okay.
And then it coalesces, gathers into this massive fire aura.
A red cloud, fire energy. In this story, that means.
Trouble. Big trouble. It's like the mountain is hoisting a flag saying, danger ahead, demon here. It's not subtle like the disguised king in Wuji.
Right.
This is a clear, powerful, visual announcement of a threat.
So much for Wukong's don't worry about it. How does he react now?
Instantly. Dramatically. Great surprise. Or maybe alarm is a better word.
Alarm, yeah.
He doesn't hesitate. Rushes forward, literally yanks Wenzhong off his horse. The phrase is Ta Xiu. Like grabbing his leg and pushing him down.
Whoa. He doesn't usually manhandle the master like that.
Exactly. And he shouts, don't go on. Stop. The demon is coming. Ta Xiu.
That reaction from Wukong, that tells you everything. If he's that freaked out by a cloud.
Then you know it's serious. Whatever gentle transition they might have hoped for after Wuji, it's over. Done. Danger is immediate.
And the others, Baji and Sha Sing.
They react just as fast, no questions asked. Baju whips out his Reikin, Sha Sang gets his staff ready, and they form up around Swan Sang.
Immediately. Surround him. Protect him.
Oh, they understand that red cloud signal just as clearly as Wukong does.
Yeah.
The battle positions are taken instantly. Let's zero in on that red light.
Yeah.
Monkey King sees it, and his immediate take is...
Demon.
Hmm.
Straight up. But interestingly, he doesn't panic.
No.
No, he actually says it's probably just a demon passing through, like maybe going to a party or some kind of demonic gathering.
Huh. So not necessarily looking to cause trouble for them.
Exactly. It's almost this casual acknowledgement of the world they live in. There are demons. Sometimes they're just commuting, you know.
Right. It shows the Monkey King has this kind of framework, doesn't he? It's not just blind fear. It's based on experience, on patterns he's seen.
Yeah, and an understanding of how things generally work, even with demons. But the Tang Monk... He hears this explanation, maybe accepts it, but his default is still trust, isn't it?
Always hope for the best, even when there's a weird red light flashing.
And that hope gets tested pretty quickly, though. Soon after, they hear it. A definite cry.
Save me. Save me. And the Tang Monk. He's all in. Compassion hits 100. Wants to find who's calling.
Instantly. No hesitation on his part.
And this is where you really see that core tension, right? Between the monk's compassion and the Monkey King's experience.
Because Monkey King hears it and immediately goes.
Nope. Dismisses it. He suggests it might be a spirit. And spirits, he says, their cries don't have echoes. It's not real. Not physical distress.
That's a fascinating detail, the echo thing. What's the thinking there?
Well, it's like he's saying a disembodied spirit wouldn't interact with the physical space in the same way. No sound bouncing off trees if there's no real source, maybe?
It's his way of sorting real danger from, I guess, supernatural noise pollution.
Kind of. And he even throws in a specific warning. Watch out for snake demons. They can steal your spirit just by hearing your name. Don't answer. Wow. Okay. So pretty specific threat. But the monk, he agrees to move on, but you sense he's not comfortable with it.
Not at all. You can almost feel his reluctance. And sure enough...
They hear it again.
Yep, second time. And this time, the Tang monk puts his foot down. He insists it sounds like a real person because it echoes.
Ah, the echo again. So for him, that's the proof. That signifies a real physical person in trouble.
Exactly. His senses, his understanding of basic physics sound echoes tell him this is legit. It overrides the Monkey King's more esoteric warnings.
So he's relying on, like, direct sensory evidence.
Yeah.
While Monkey King's working off this deeper unseen knowledge.
Precisely. And the Monkey King, he clearly sees this as a trap. Right. But the monk isn't getting it, so what does he do?
He tries to protect them anyway. Uses a spell.
Yeah, some kind of distancing spell. Tries to put some space between them and whatever's making that sound. It's proactive protection, even if the monk just thinks he's being difficult.
And then, just when they think they're maybe past it.
Cry number three. And this time, it sounds like it's coming from behind them.
Oh, that's unsettling.
Right. Now they both just want to get away fast. Monkey King feels, you know, probably vindicated. The monk is maybe a bit embarrassed now. It seems like he's just resigned to moving on.
Okay, but then the narrative does something interesting. It shifts.
Yeah, we suddenly get the demon's point of view, which is great.
And the demon is annoyed.
Pretty much frustrated. Like, why haven't they taken the bait yet? Its first attempts failed. What does this tell us about deception, you think?
That it's adaptable, maybe. Mm-hmm. If plan A doesn't work.
You switch to plan B. You find the vulnerability. You escalate. And that's exactly what happens. The demon decides on a much more direct approach. Very manipulative.
That's so.
It transforms into this image of utter helplessness. A little kid, maybe 7 years old, naked, tied to a big pine tree, still crying.
Oh, wow. That's potent imagery.
Incredibly potent. Designed to hit you right in the empathy bone, bypass all the skepticism. Who wouldn't want to help that child?
The vulnerability, the nakedness, being tied up.
Yeah.
It just screams, rescue me.
Exactly. But the Monkey King sees right through it instantly.
He recognizes the energy?
Yep. The text says he knows it's the demon back again, and his reaction is pure instinct. Push the Tang monk off the horse, yell at Pigsy and Sandy to be ready.
Why push the monk? That seems harsh.
From the Monkey King's view, it's necessary. He knows the monk's compassion is the weak point here. Get him away, physically stop him from rushing into the trap before he even processes it.
A forceful intervention born out of, well, perceived necessity.
Totally. And what's really revealing is what the demon is thinking. It actually admires the Tang monk's goodness in a way.
Really?
Yeah, but it identifies the real problem. The Monkey King. The observant one. That's who needs to be dealt with first. It's strategic.
Smart. Calculating. Then it goes back to the disguise.
Uh-huh. Returns to the child form, but now even closer to them, making it unavoidable.
So confrontation time again. Monkey King tries to explain, again, the passing demon thing.
Yeah, maybe hoping the absurdity of demon turning into a kid will finally click for the monk.
But the monk's reaction this time is different.
Oh, yeah. He's furious. He feels completely tricked, but not by the demon he can't see. He feels betrayed by the Monkey King.
Because Monkey King pushed him, and now he's repeating this, what seems like a ridiculous excuse.
Exactly. It's this massive clash. The monk sees apparent goodness and helplessness. The Monkey King sees a deadly trap based on hard experience. Belief versus cynicism, almost.
And the monk's anger leads him to do something pretty drastic.
He starts reciting the spell, the tightening headband spell.
Oof, that's serious. That causes the Monkey King physical pain, right? It's his ultimate punishment.
It is. It shows just how utterly convinced the monk is. He's willing to inflict pain on his protector because he believes so strongly that compassion is being ignored, that injustice is happening right here.
It's a powerful moment of conviction, even if, you know, maybe misguided in this instance.
Absolutely. And Sandy has to jump in, right? Plead with the monk to stop. It shows how tense things have become. The group could actually fracture over this.
But the monk sees the child now, with his own eyes, tied to the tree, hearing the cries.
And that visual confirmation seals it for him. Everything clicks into place, confirming his interpretation. So he just lays into the Monkey King.
Accuses him of being heartless. Suspicious.
Pretty much. No compassion. Always seeing demons everywhere. Just total dressing down.
And the Monkey King, what can he do?
Nothing. He's trapped. He knows the truth. But if he moves, if he tries to attack the child, the monk will likely tighten that headband again.
So he's silenced. Rendered powerless by the very person he's trying to protect.
The irony is thick, isn't it? The one who sees clearly can't act.
And so the Tang monk, completely oblivious to the demon's true nature,
walks right up to the child, ready to untie him, offer help, and asks, you know, what on earth has happened?
And this is where the performance begins. Because, well, this isn't a child at all, is it?
Not even close. It's a demon in disguise, and it launches into what you can only describe as an incredibly elaborate, tearful. Yeah. I mean, it's an Oscar-worthy performance, really.
It's stunning in its detail, actually. The demon claims to be from this incredibly wealthy family nearby. Even gives specific, clearly made-up names for his grandfather, Red Millionaire, and his father, Red 100,000. Paints this picture of immense family fortune, gold, silver, the works.
But then, of course, the tragedy strikes, according to the lie. The family wealth is lost, supposedly due to extravagance and lending money that just wasn't repaid. And then things turn violent.
Oh, it escalates dramatically. The demon claims robbers attacked their home, killed his father, abducted his mother to be a stockade wife.
Right, implying she was forced into some role in the robber stronghold.
And were about to kill him, the child too.
But the mother, in this desperate plea, she supposedly begged for her child's life. So instead of killing him, they allegedly just left him hanging on this tree for 3 entire days and nights, exposed to the elements, meant to freeze or starve to death.
And then comes the emotional manipulation. The demon lays the gratitude on thick, practically weeping as he thanks the monk for showing up, and promises a reward, offering to sell himself or any remaining family land and property just to show his thanks.
And Tang Senzang, he completely, totally buys it. His compassion just overrides any skepticism he might have had. He immediately tells Baji, cut the child down. And Baji, well, always ready for action, especially when land or reward is mentioned, he's instantly on board.
But Wukong.
Ugh.
Wukong smells a rat immediately. He sees right through the entire act.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't waste a second. He challenges the child directly. Points out the obvious holes, right? Like, who would I return you to if your parents are gone? What reward could you possibly give if everything is gone? Basically saying, this lie is full of holes. He's calling it out, point blank.
What's really telling here is how the demon reacts to Wukong's sharpness.
Hmm.
It's scared. It recognizes Wukong isn't going to be easily fooled. So what does it do? It adapts instantly.
It's a quick pivot, yeah. It tweaks the lie just enough to try and, you know, address Wukong's points. It quickly says the parents are empty, meaning dead, sure, but claims there are still relatives and undeveloped land remaining.
And it gets even more specific. Invents names for these supposed relatives. Li Si from the stream's head. The uncle.
Uh-huh.
Hong San from the woods, a cousin. And there are other uncles and cousins supposedly still in the village. And importantly, it reiterates the promise of reward, selling the land after being saved.
And this is where Baji, well, unfortunately, he lets his desires cloud his judgment. He overrules Wukong. Baji is just completely fixated on the mention of land and reward. He dismisses Wukong's doubts, which were totally valid.
He argues, what is it? It's just a small child. Robbers wouldn't take everything. And you can almost hear him thinking he's already calculating the potential payoff. Specifically mentions the 10 mole of land price, which he says even they couldn't eat through. It's such a classic Baji moment, isn't it? Driven by potential gain.
Totally Baji. And so, despite Wukong's warning, he just goes ahead and cuts the child down with his rake.
Now, the demon is free, but it doesn't just jump down and run off. Oh, no. It keeps the act going, playing coy, playing weak.
Pretends its hands and feet are numb, its waist aching. All part of the manipulation.
And then comes the really clever bit. It refuses to ride the horse, claims it's unfamiliar, it's painful, but then it refuses to be carried by Baji, complaining about his long snout, big ears, and stiff mane, hurting its delicate frozen skin.
Ouch, that's a very specific insult. And it refuses Sha Monk too. Claims his unlucky face looks like the scary robber's and makes it lose its soul. It's systematically eliminating the potential carriers, you see.
Until Wukong offers. And the demon, thinking its plan is perfectly on track, happily agrees. Yes, let the Monkey King carry me. It thinks it's got the clever one right where it wants him.
But Wukong isn't agreeing because he believes the act for a second. He's agreeing because he's testing his suspicion. As he prepares to lift the child, he checks its weight.
And he notices something immediately off. It only weighs 3 caddies, 10 odd tails, so less than 4 caddies. He instantly calls the child out again. You're a demon, he says flat out. Demands to know why its weight is so low for a supposed 7-year-old who should weigh closer to 7 caddies.
The demon kind of fumbles for excuses. Small frame, lost milk as a child. Really weak excuses.
Yeah, totally unconvincing. Wukong, clearly frustrated, but, well, accepting the task for now, agrees to carry the child anyway. But not without a sarcastic little dig, right? About needing to be told if it has to pee. It's Wukong basically saying, okay, I'm playing along, but I know exactly what you are.
So Tang, Sun Zhang, Baji, and Shamunk, they just walk ahead, completely oblivious, while Wukong follows, carrying this demon, and the source gives us this great little peek into Wukong's internal frustration. He's thinking about how tough this journey is, especially through these treacherous mountains, and now he has to carry someone, especially this thing he knows is a demon. He even briefly thinks about just, you know, throwing the demon off a cliff right then and there.
And the demon, well, maybe it senses Wukong's thoughts. Mm. Or maybe it just realized that the game is truly up. Either way, it makes its next move, uses a magic technique.
It inhales four breaths and blows them onto Wukong's back.
And instantly, dramatically, Wukong feels the weight on his back just explode to 1,000 caddies. He calls out the trick immediately, recognizes the specific magic. My child, you're using the heavy body technique.
Right. So now it's exposed. Fearing Wukong's power, the demon performs a different kind of desperate technique. Corpse release, Sin, Jisha. This is where it sends its original spirit, its Yuanshen, out of its physical body and up into the sky, basically abandoning the physical shell.
But here's where it gets really interesting, and this is a crucial detail from the source text. After the spirit leaves, the physical body left on Wukong's back doesn't get lighter. It increases in weight even more.
It's like a final paradoxical burden left behind, a last trick. And Wukong, I mean, he is absolutely furious at this point. He grabs this heavy, now apparently lifeless, physical body.
And he is not gentle. He smashes it violently onto a sharp rock, turning it, as the source describes so vividly, into a meat patty. He's still wary, though, so he takes it further, tears off its limbs, scatters them, just to make absolutely sure this physical form is completely, utterly destroyed.
You'd think that would be the end of it, right? Physical body obliterated. But the demon, watching from the sky in its spirit form, is enraged by the destruction of its body. It decides, okay, enough is enough. The trickery, the delays, they're over. It needs to capture Tang San Zhang, and it needs to do it now.
And it does this by unleashing pure power. It conjures up this massive, incredibly fierce whirlwind.
The description of this wind is intense. It's roaring, rolling water and cloud, a black cube blocking out the sun. It's tearing up trees by their roots, leveling plants, whipping up flying sand that blinds everyone, making the path impassable with broken rocks. The source even notes that animals are just screaming in fear. It's chaos.
The sheer power of this wind just overwhelms the entire group. Tang San Zhang can barely stay on his horse. Baji can't even look up. Shamuk has to cover his face just to protect himself from all the debris flying around.
In Wukong, he realizes instantly, this devastating wind, this is the demon spirit. It's attacking. He tries to chase it down.
But the demon riding the wind itself in its spirit form is just too fast. In the chaos, it swoops in, grabs Tang San Zhang, the one person it truly wants, and just vanishes completely without a trace.
Wow.
The wind stops, sun comes out, but it's chaos. The white dragon horse is literally trembling, neighing. Luggage everywhere.
Baji's groaning somewhere near a cliff. Shamunk's up on a slope calling out.
And then Sun Wukong reappears. Baji kind of dusts himself off, grabs him. Brother, what a wind.
Shamunk confirms, yeah, whirlwind. But his first question, the desperate one, is where's the master?
Baji says they all just hunkered down. Figured the master did too, on the horse. But now, looking around.
And Shamunk uses this really vivid phrase from the text. He says it's like the master was just swept away, like a lamp wick, just snuffed out. Gone.
It's such a picture of vulnerability. And right then, in that panic, Wukong says something, well, something pretty shocking.
Okay, yeah, reading this, I was like, wait, what? He sees the mess, knows the master's missing, and his first suggestion is, brothers, from here, we should just disband. Seriously, disband.
Seems totally wrong, doesn't it? But then Baji, well, Baji jumps right in.
Oh, of course he does. Ever the opportunist for an easier path.
He agrees immediately. Complains the journey's endless, asks when will we reach it, suggests they just split up, go their own ways. How good would that be, he says.
Classic Baji, always looking for the exit ramp. But Shamunk's reaction, the text says he was struck dumb. Numb. And then he just lets loose.
And this is a key moment for Shamunk, really shows his core. He reminds them forcefully about their past lives, their sins.
And about Bodhisattva Guanyin, how she saved them, gave them this chance.
Exactly. Persuaded them to convert, take vows, get new names, and commit to this specific mission, protecting Tang Monk, getting the scriptures all to atone.
He argues that quitting now, it's not just giving up, it's betraying Guanyin's kindness. It ruins their virtue. They'd be a laughingstock, you know, having a beginning but no end.
It's a really powerful appeal. It hits them right in their shared purpose, their spiritual contract. And you see, it works on Wukong. He hears Sha Monk out.
And then he explains why he suggested disbanding. It wasn't indifference. It was sheer exasperation, deep frustration.
And here's the reveal. He says his fiery golden eyes, you know, the ones that see through everything. They saw the truth about that child they met just before the storm.
The one hanging in the tree.
That's the one. Wukong knew instantly. Demon, he says.
But the master and the others, they just saw a kid. And they wanted Wukong to carry him.
Right. Wukong tried to handle it, but the demon used a heavy body spell, pinned him down. Wukong says he smashed it to pieces, but it must have been an illusion, a trick.
Because the demon used a corpse separation method, basically faked its death, and used the whirlwind as cover to grab the master.
So Wukong's frustration comes from this pattern. He sees the danger, he warns them, the master especially doesn't listen because of his compassion, and then disaster. It left him feeling discouraged.
That phrase, Yurian Sanu, it's like will lazy, heart ash, just completely burnt out, losing faith in the process.
It really nails that core conflict, doesn't it? Tang Monk's sometimes naive compassion versus Wukong, often harsh but accurate perception.
But Sha Monk's sincerity seems to pull Wukong back.
It does. Seeing Sha Monk is serious, Wukong turns on Baji. Like, okay, what are you really about?
And Baji, maybe seeing the way the wind is blowing or maybe genuinely moved by Sha Monk, he folds.
Yeah, he quickly backtracks, admits he was talking nonsense. Says, no, no, we shouldn't disband. We follow Sha Monk's lead, find the demon, save the master.
And Wukong's mood just flips. The text says, Hu Kui Chan Zua turns anger into happiness. Instantly.
Right then, he's back in leader mode, rallies them, unite, gather the stuff, get the horse, let's go search.
So internal crisis averted, thanks to Sha Monk. Now the actual search begins.
They head up the mountain, travel maybe 50, 70 lund. That's quite a distance searching everywhere.
Nothing. No master, no demon. And the mountain itself is described as eerily quiet. No birds, no animals, just old trees.
That silence, that emptiness, it seems to get under Wukong's skin. His anxiety ramps up.
To the point where he just explodes, leaps onto a peak, shouts, transform!
And changes into his mega form. Three heads, six arms. The one from the Havoc in Heaven.
Yeah, this isn't just standard fighting mode. This is maximum overkill mode.
He shakes his cudgel, makes three of them, and just starts smashing the mountainside indiscriminately. East, west. The text uses this sound effect. Say, would be dead deck. Just crashing, tearing sounds.
Archie sees this and thinks, oh no, he's finally lost it. The frustration's driven him mad.
But the smashing, it doesn't bring out the demon. It brings out, well, someone else. A group of really pathetic-looking mountain gods and earth spirits.
The description is pretty vivid, isn't it? Ragged clothes, trousers without crotches or openings, just looking miserable. And they kneel right down.
They explain this is a 600 Li Zhuantuhao mountain. There's a god and a spirit every 10 Li, so 30 of each. And they apologize for being slow to greet him, thinking that's why he's tearing up the place.
Wukong, maybe a bit surprised by who showed up, calms down enough to ask them about demons.
And, oh boy, do they have a story. They complain bitterly. There's only one demon here, they say. But this one demon
has made their lives hell. They say he's polished their heads, meaning he's taken everything.
Exactly. Left them totally destitute. No offerings, no food, terrible clothes. Because this one demon consumes it all. They stress, it's not many demons, just this one tyrant.
And they give details. He lives down in a ravine called Withered Pine Ravine, his cave. Fire Cloud Cave.
And he's incredibly powerful. He doesn't just ignore the local gods, he actively captures them.
Forces them to do chores, like burning fires, blocking doors.
Yeah, and even makes him stand outside his cave at night, holding bells and shouting challenges, like guards or town criers for him.
Yeah.
And his little minions demand regular payments.
Wukong asks, okay, but how do you guys, as spirits, yin ghosts, have money?
They confirm they don't. So their payment. They're forced to hunt, catch mountain deer and wild game.
And bring these offerings to the demons morning and night. That's rough.
It is. And if they fail, the demons threaten to tear down their temples, strip their clothes, basically make their existence even more miserable. They are begging Wukong to deal with this guy.
It really shows you something, doesn't it? Even local deities can be totally oppressed by a sufficiently powerful demon setting up shop.
Absolutely. So Wukong asks the key questions. Where is he from? What's his name?
And this is the big twist. The gods tell him. Well, they think Wukong might even know him.
He's the son of the Bull Demon King and the Rakshasa woman, Princess Iron Fan.
Whoa.
And there's more. He cultivated for 300 years at Flaming Mountain, mastered the Samadhi True Fire, very rare, very powerful magic.
His father, Bull Demon King, sent him here to guard this mountain, his infant name, Red Boy, his title, Great Sage Infant King.
Now, Wukong's reaction to this news
is
wild. The source says he becomes full of joy, just like that, beaming.
Total turnaround from smashing mountainsides and frustration. He just dismisses the poor gods, changes back to normal.
And tells Baji and Shamunk, hey, no problem, the master's safe. Why? Because the demon is related to me.
Which, okay, hold on, related. Baji says exactly what I was thinking. He points out the huge distance, mountains, oceans between Flower Fruit Mountain and here. How are they related?
And Shamunk laughs. He adds that old proverb, 3 years absent, even family isn't family, after 500 or 600 years. With no contact, no visits, no gifts exchanged, come on, this demon isn't gonna care.
So Wukong lays out his logic. Back in the day, 500 years ago, during the Havoc and Heaven time, he traveled a lot, made powerful friends.
Including the Bull Demon King. He says Bull Demon King was the eldest of like 5 or 6 sworn demon brothers. And Wukong was the youngest, the smallest.
So he considered Bull Demon King his elder brother, his Duggo.
Right. So Wukong's thinking is, if Red Boy is Bull Demon King's son, and Bull Demon King is my sworn elder brother, then Red Boy is kind of like my nephew. Or, as he puts it, Wukong is Red Boy's old uncle.
Ah, okay. So it's based on that sworn brotherhood connection from centuries ago.
Exactly. And Wukong is totally confident. Even if Red Boy doesn't recognize the connection immediately, he reasons, he wouldn't dare harm his old uncle's master. He thinks Red Boy will just hand over Tang Merc, whole and intact. Maybe you don't even need much persuading.
It's optimistic, but it's a different tactic for Wukong, right? Relying on connection, not just force.
It is. It's a glimpse into his pre-pilgrimage life, those demon alliances. Little nugget here. Sometimes even Wukong tries diplomacy first, based on old ties, however thin they seem now.
And even though Baji and Shamunk are clearly skeptical about this ancient family connection working,
Wukong's confidence seems to settle things. They're not talking about disbanding anymore. They have a destination. A plan, sort of.
They're resolved. So the three brothers gather the horse, the luggage, and head straight for the place the gods described.
They travel fast now, day and night, about another 100 lines. They find a pine forest, a stream inside it. Clear, flowing, living water.
And at the end of the stream, there it is. A stone bridge leading to a shimmering stone cliff.
This gotta be it. Wukong points. That cliff, that cave on the other side. That's the demon's place. Fire Cloud Cave.
Okay, time for tactics. Wukong asks, who stays, who goes? Who watches the horse and luggage, who comes with me to confront this?
Then Aji steps up. Maybe he's feeling bold now or just bored. He says he doesn't like sitting still. Hey, Shen's watching. He'll go with Wukong.
Never a dull moment with Baji. So Wukong tells Shamunk, okay, you hide the horse and luggage deep in the woods. Guard them well.
Shamunk, reliable as ever, does just that. Wukong and Baji grab their weapons, monkey and pig, ready to go.
They head towards the cave. And the text leaves us right there, but with this little couplet hinting at what's next.
Yeah. Before refining the infant Red Boy, evil fire prevails. Heart Monkey Wukong and Wood Mother Baji support each other.
Evil fire. That sounds like trouble. And it highlights Red Boy's power.
Definitely pointing towards his Samadhi True Fire. And it sets up the confrontation with Wukong, Heart Monkey, and Baji. Wood Mother may be linking to his wooden rake, needing to work together.